Live from the Ken and Valerie Baker Studio at WHYY, this is Studio 2.
On Monday, October 13th, welcome to Studio 2 on WHYY. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. Cherry Gregg is off today. It is indeed a historic day in the Middle East. Hamas has released the last of the living Israeli hostages held inside Gaza. In exchange, Israel has released nearly 2,000 Palestinian prisoners. After 2 years of bloodshed and devastation, there is a fragile sense of hope, if not for a lasting peace, at least a period of relative calm. The war in Gaza may have taken place many thousands of miles from here, but we know for many of you listening, it felt much closer. Perhaps it deepened beliefs you already had, or maybe it caused you to rethink long-held assumptions about the Middle East, America's role in the world, the media, or even your personal relationships. Our phone lines are open, and we would love to hear from you today. Did the war in Gaza change your perspective on the world? If so, how? And what do you see as the major impediments to a lasting peace in the region? Give us a call. The number is 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. If you're on YouTube or Facebook, hello, drop a comment in the chat. As we wait to hear from you, let's set up the show today. Later on, we're going to hear from a pair of people in our region with deep ties to this conflict, and we'll get a sense of how they experienced the last 2 years. But first, we want to explore the geopolitics. How exactly was the Trump administration able to broker this ceasefire, and what hurdles lie ahead? For that, we turn to Robin Wright, a contributing writer and columnist for The New Yorker. Robin has reported on the Middle East for half a century. Robin, thanks for being here on Studio 2.
Hi, Javi. It's a big day in the Middle East.
It is indeed. Obviously, you could take this question, this first question, any number of directions, but I want you to give your most succinct explanation for why this ceasefire happened now.
Oh, succinct on the Middle East.
Do your best, Robin.
Yeah. So I think there are a number of factors. First of all, Hamas has been deeply weakened, and the so-called axis of resistance across the Middle East, sponsored by Iran, Hezbollah in Lebanon, of course, the fall of the Syrian regime, backed by Iran, and Hamas obviously weakened too. This is a moment that strategically changed events on the ground, how long Hamas could fight. But I also think there was a shift in terms of Israel as well. I think Bibi Netanyahu knew he was in trouble politically, and more importantly, that Americans, for the first time, were increasingly critical of the Israeli government, him specifically, and had and that public opinion had begun to turn toward sympathy or empathy anyway for the Palestinians, and the fact that 67,000 have been killed and now 93% of the buildings have been destroyed in Gaza. So I think there are a number of different factors. It's that confluence of events and factors that always lead to peace. There's not just one moment. But Trump also, I think, exerted his leverage on all parties in the Middle East to try to get this resolved.
Let's talk about Trump exerting his leverage and why he decided to do so now. Certainly, there's some hyperbole in his statements about how important this day is. Perhaps history will prove him right. We'll see. But it cannot be denied that he seemed to focus more on this conflict in recent days and weeks than perhaps he had in prior months. And I think there is some mystery as to why. Can you decode that mystery for us, Robin?
I think there's only one person who could decode that, and I think that's the president himself. It's clearly in contrast to some of his earlier statements when he talked about that, you know, people in Gaza will have to leave Gaza en masse, that they would have to move someplace else. And the peace agreement that has been agreed to today includes a statement that Gazans are encouraged to stay, that Hamas members can stay if they disarm and they pledge not to attack Israel, So there is a change, I think, both in the president's thinking and the terms that Steve Witkoff, the U.S. Special Envoy, and Jared Kushner, his son-in-law and advisor, were offering to players in the region that seemed more feasible than some of the earlier ideas this year.
Kushner gave an interesting interview to the New York Times, and I'm paraphrasing here, but what he essentially said is that he and Witkoff are true deal makers and that they were able to get everyone around the table in a way that diplomats and academics cannot, that there's something sort of inherent about deal making that they possess that the folks who've worked on this conflict in the past do not. Again, I'm paraphrasing here, but I'm curious if you lend any credence to what Kushner is saying there.
Well, the Trump administration is clearly transactional when it comes to its foreign policy. Historically, American diplomats, at least since the U.S. became a superpower after World War II, would methodically think through the various options, whether it's for, you know, some kind of broader foreign policy or was to end a war, and would think through the specific steps. The one thing that is obvious about this plan is that it deals with the kind of headline issue, and that was the Israeli hostages who'd been held now for 738 days, and the destruction in the Palestinian territories. The hostages have been released, but this is where the details of the agreement start getting fuzzier.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the great lines is, what could go wrong now? And the answer is everything, because the details are so undecided and the process is likely not just to take days or weeks or months, but potentially years.
Before we get into those potential trip up points, I want to ask you how you feel adherence to the agreement has gone so far. These are early, tense, fragile days, but they're still very, very important days. Has the adherence to the plan so far surprised you in any way, whether that's fallen short of your expectations or exceeded your expectations?
No, I think that I'm struck, I think everyone's struck, that this initial phase went extremely well. It's the first 72 hours from the moment of a ceasefire and Israelis begin to withdraw a bit, and the release of the 20 living hostages with the remains scheduled to be released by Thursday. So this first phase has gone extremely well. I think everyone was surprised that, I mean, those who know the Middle East have been surprised by how fast this has been pulled together in the end game. But again, this is so much focused on phase one with no details about the economic, military, or political steps in the quagmire, potentially, that lies ahead.
I want to read a comment from one of our listeners who chooses to remain anonymous, but it's a really interesting comment. This person says, the media is in a celebratory mood but has jumped the gun. How much hope is possible when, despite the important prisoner exchange between Israel and Hamas, we are very far from any justice or rebuilding for Palestinians? Very little has been solved. There have been several previous ceasefires without this much hype. Trump has played the media like a fiddle. How much truth do you think there is in that statement, Robin? And I think it is important, I guess, to try to distinguish between this particular ceasefire and those that have come before it. Are there ways in which this ceasefire truly does stand out, or are we simply rehashing an old pattern?
Yes, I've covered every war, revolution, and uprising in the Middle East since the 1973 war, and I've seen a lot of peace processes start only to kind of unravel either very quickly or with time. Events on the ground in the Middle East often, almost usually, overtake diplomacy. And that's the challenge again here. And I think your listener has made an important point that the Israelis managed to get back the hostages. The question is, what do you do now with Gaza? The idea of this Board of Peace ruling over Gaza, the idea of disarming Hamas completely, the idea of finding a new government that will be embraced by all or the majority of Palestinians. The idea of stabilizing Gaza, given the destruction. And how does that play out? You know, who gets helped first and what do you do first? Water and sewage and telephone lines, or do you begin rebuilding homes so that people don't live in tents for the next year, two, three, four, or five? So these are some of the great questions. And I think the danger is that if there isn't swift movement in dealing with the realities and the tragedies in Gaza, that there's the danger that you see the emergence of, you know, whether it's Hamas 3.0 or resentment about the process. You know, we're also talking about, you know, tens of thousands, potentially troops, international forces on the ground. And what are the rules of engagement? And, you know, who's going to pay for all of this? Because President Trump has made clear that the United States and the U.S. taxpayers are not going to foot the bill. A lot of big questions out there.
I want to remind folks that our phone lines are open, as is our email inbox. We're asking you this hour, did the war in Gaza change your perspective on the world in any way? If so, how? And what do you see as the major impediments to a lasting peace in the region? Robin Wright just laid out several. Give us a call, 888-477-9499. You can email studio2@whyy.org. If you're on YouTube or Facebook, drop a comment in the chat. Dry Molasses on YouTube says, this conflict has opened my eyes to the prevalence of propaganda and media choosiness. Everyone I know in real life, even far-right people, has seen the violence and taken the side of Palestine. But the media says otherwise. You mentioned earlier, Robin Wright, that changing public sentiment in America played a role here and perhaps brought Netanyahu to the table. And there's this broader question now of what is Israel's relationship to the international community? You hear this word isolated or increasingly isolated over and over and over again. How true is that, first of all? And how much does Israel care about how the international community views it?
Well, I'll tell you one striking image. I was at the United Nations last month for the opening of the General Assembly when Bibi Netanyahu, the Prime Minister of Israel, gave his speech. And what was stunning was the number of delegations in this cavernous assembly hall that walked out in protest over Gaza. And put that next to the kind of meeting that's being held in Sharm el-Sheikh today between President Trump and heads of state from dozens of countries trying to back the Gaza peace plan and, you know, talk about how to normalize a transition politically, economically, and military across the Middle East. So we've seen a stunning reversal. Now, what will be interesting is, because of Israeli politics, how this plays out at home and therefore influences what happens in terms of Israel's image around the world. There's an election scheduled for about a year from now, and Bibi will be fighting for his political life as he has done successfully for decades now. And if, you know, there are always those charges, criminal charges that loom over his shoulder if he should lose. So, you know, there's a lot at stake here in so many ways. And this is why the next year will be fascinating, because so much has to get done so quickly, whether it's for Israeli politics or for life in Gaza, just very basic life in Gaza now.
Brian comments, Trump is obsessed with putting himself front and center of attention. He's recently become obsessed with the belief that he deserves the Nobel Peace Prize, something that he and his administration have mentioned several times. It brings me to this question, Robin Wright. And by the way, keep those calls and comments coming. 888-477-9499. Email studio2@whyy.org. It brings me to this question. I think there is a sentiment out there. I don't know how widely held this sentiment is. The sentiment being that Netanyahu, in this moment, is giving Trump the attention and essentially the press tour that he wants, with all intentions of finding a way to break this agreement and continue the assault, whether it's for his political future or for any other reason. Do you lend much credence to that theory that this is simply another political gambit by Netanyahu, no genuine interest in a lasting ceasefire in Gaza?
Well, look, the reality for Bibi Netanyahu is that the far right in his coalition want to keep the West Bank and Gaza. This is what we're looking and focusing on Gaza today, but the reality is that there's a lot happening in the West Bank as well in terms of settlements and the questions about how viable is the West Bank as a potential state. And the Trump outline deal does call at the very end, at the end of all this stabilization and reconstruction and security for a Palestinian state, understanding that that is what Palestinians want. This is where it gets down to the nitty gritty. I think that both sides, Hamas and Israel, both accepted this agreement with reservations, and those reservations have to be overcome. Bibi Netanyahu knows how to pump up President Trump, and he's done that. And in the process, Trump has pumped up Bibi Netanyahu, which is good for Bibi's long-term political survival. I think there was a yes, but from both sides. And the question is, do those buts, those reservations, now become the challenges in seeing this deal through, very complicated deal through?
I am curious. We talked earlier about all the potential tripping points along the way. You said over the next year, that was the timeline that you really laid out there. Is there one that you look at right now, just from today? I know you don't have a crystal ball, but there's one that you look at right now and say, this is the thorniest one issue as we move through the next year.
Don't get me wrong. I don't believe anything major can be achieved in the kind of miracles required in one year. Yeah. I think we're talking about a decade-long process, as has been true with earlier peace efforts. I think that economically, you have to rebuild an area the size of Greater Philadelphia, almost from scratch. Think about that. Politically, you have to come up with a government that's apolitical, acceptable to Palestinians, and that includes international community. Militarily, you have to disarm Hamas. And remember, Hamas is not the most militant group in Gaza. There's the Palestinian Islamic Jihad, and there are others, much smaller militant groups. So I think this is where both Netanyahu in Israel and Hamas in Gaza are going to be dealing with their extremist components or elements in their areas and having to make sure that they continue to play ball. And, we have a long history in this region of one event unraveling the whole thing.
We also mentioned earlier U.S. public opinion, which you believe played a role in bringing Israel and Netanyahu to the table. I think one of the big open questions, and we're going to transition later in the show to some more local perspectives. I think one of the big open questions is how much has American sentiment shifted and how permanent is that shift? I'm curious for your sort of quick and dirty perspective on that.
American public opinion being consistent. I'm not there.
Yeah.
I've seen too much, American public opinion changing, sometimes in dramatic ways. This is a moment where I think those who were critical of Bibi will say, he agreed to end the war. And so some public opinion may change. I mean, I have American Jewish friends who were very critical of Netanyahu because of the destruction or the scope of death in Gaza. And I think it will be very interesting how this plays out. But again, it's a question of keeping everybody on board. And the problem, I think, is President Trump has a limited attention span. He's got his own government that's in the midst of a shutdown. He's promised he's going to end the war in Ukraine and Russia. He talked about that today, and that's his next big effort. And he also threw out, bringing the Iranians on board. There's just an awful lot that has to be done. And American public opinion, also has a pretty short attention span. And so the question is momentum, 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 momentum. And it will, really generating the commitment long term to this for all the players involved is going to be the first challenge.
Well, thank you for walking us through some of those challenges today. Robin Wright, contributing writer and columnist for The New Yorker, has been covering this region for half a century. Robin, thank you so much for your time today on Studio 2.
Sure, Robbie. Great to be with you.
Let me give out the email address again, studio2@whyy.org. We're asking you, did the war in Gaza change your perspective on the world? If so, how? What do you see as the major impediments to a lasting peace in the region? We'll answer those questions and much more on the other side of this break. You're listening to Studio 2 on WHYY. Don't go anywhere. And welcome back to Studio 2 on WHYY. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. Cherry Gregg is off today. We are continuing our conversation this hour on the ceasefire between Hamas and Israel. New Yorker contributor and columnist Robin Wright gave us a great summary of the diplomatic stakes and where the peace process could go next. Now it's time to zoom in and hear some personal perspectives from our neighbors in the Delaware Valley. Later in the show, we'll hear from a Palestinian American who's been a major organizer in the local community. But first, let's welcome Michael Balaban, CEO of the Jewish Federation of Greater Philadelphia. Michael, thanks for being here on Studio 2.
Avi, thank you for having me.
Of course, our listeners and viewers, we'd love to hear from you. Did the war in Gaza change your perspective on the world? If so, how? What do you see as the major impediments to a lasting peace in the region? The email address is studio2@whyy.org. If you're on YouTube or Facebook, drop a comment in the chat. Lots of comments, of course, many of them very strong. Lacey says, stop calling it war when the UN has already declared that Israel has been committing genocide against the Palestinian people. Say genocide. States don't have a right to exist. People do. I'll note that the United Nations Commission of Inquiry says Israel has committed genocide against Palestinians in Gaza. I think that's what the commenter is referring to. Ivana on Facebook says the devastation and suffering of Palestinians in Gaza is profoundly distressing, both to me as an American and as a person of faith. At the same time, the horrific plight of the Israeli hostages and their families is absolutely agonizing. I am convinced that peace between Israel and Palestine is essential. Mike, I'm curious first for your reaction to the news of the ceasefire and everything that has transpired over the last roughly 72 hours. Your emotional, your gut response.
Yep. First, the last comment, email that you received, peace is essential. This has been 2 years of an emotional roller coaster, and even before that. But starting with 2 years ago on October 7th, when Hamas terrorists came in, murdered, abducted, so 1,200 Israelis were murdered, over 250 individuals taken captive as hostage. We saw some releases. It's just been gut-wrenching. And certainly I have empathy for innocent individuals that were caught in the middle of Hamas's brutality. And let's be clear, this is a war that Hamas started. And Palestinians have been caught in the middle under the brutality of the leadership of Hamas. Israel had no interest in being at war. And yet, when you're bombarded every single day, and when your citizens are taken captive, and held hostage. You can't just sit back. You can't sit in fear. You have to respond.
Let me get a sense of your personal connection to the region. So have you traveled to Israel or to the region since October 7th? And do you have family there? Give me a sense of how your lens, so people understand that as they're hearing you speak today.
I grew up traveling back and forth to Israel multiple times every year since I was a little child. I am a dual citizen. I am back and forth in Israel easily 5 or 6 times a year. I head back to Israel on the 26th. I play a role both here in the States as a volunteer firefighter. I am also part of a IDF dispatch as a firefighter in Israel. So when Hezbollah rockets were being fired from the north into civilian communities there, I was dispatched with U.S. firefighters to help fight those fires.
What do you think you see from that perspective that some of your neighbors here in Philadelphia do not see?
One, there's what you see on the news,
sure,
which is very binary versus, you know, as a firefighter in Israel, we respond to Arab villages. We respond to, we don't ask the question, who are you? What's your background? When we go to aid someone from a fire or from an emergency, we're there to help people. And the level of coexistence on the ground in Israel is tremendous. And one of the reasons why October 7th was so gut-wrenching, if you look at the communities that surround Gaza, most of the individuals were working to forge peace. There are numerous accounts of families in Be'eri or Neir Oz, communities that right up against the border fence, that in any given day were working to shuttle Palestinians to medical services in Israel, cancer treatments, everyday individuals looking to have a dream of a better future. And then Hamas attacked, and this war broke out, and we had to defend our borders. But everyone I know in Israel, so we want a brighter future for the entire region, for all the individuals.
Jessica comments, the last few years opened my eyes to just how Jew hatred spreads. I don't mean anti-Israel. I mean sentiments that genuinely cross the line seen as acceptable, from calling October 7th justified to the ignoring of the murder of a peace protester in Colorado. It also showed me how little anyone in the West knows about the history of the region and how willing they are to follow TikTok influencers to form their own views. How have you seen anti-Semitism here in this region since October 7th? Are you alarmed at all? And where do you see that conversation going now?
I'm deeply alarmed. It's grown by over 400%. The level of incidents that have taken place, and they go beyond playground bullying to violent attacks. Here in our own state, the governor's mansion was, a Molotov cocktail thrown in. We've seen attacks across the country targeting Jews for being Jewish. That's not a political statement that individuals are making. It's anti-Semitism. If you don't like the Israeli government, okay. But to attack someone who runs a kosher restaurant or a non-kosher restaurant, just is owned by someone Jewish, that goes beyond politics. That's anti-Semitism. So.
Do you think that the Jewish community here in this region is increasingly divided on how people view Israel and this particular conflict? I'm looking at some recent poll results from the Washington Post. Most American Jews say Israel has committed war crimes against Palestinians. 4 in 10 say Israel has committed genocide. Do you acknowledge that a deep rift forming within the Jewish community?
Well, I'll say today, the majority of the Jewish community is united in our relief that the hostages are back. We are really celebrating that hopefully we can move towards a new phase of peace in the Middle East. But yes, the world is divided. I'm stunned.
So the answer is yes. You believe that there is a growing disagreement among Jews.
Yeah, some of it is politics, mm-hmm. and whether you like Bibi Netanyahu or don't like Bibi Netanyahu, to me that's fine. Feel free. But this Israel exists, and the world has to stop questioning the existence of Israel. It exists, it continues to thrive, and it will thrive. And in 1948, there was the opportunity for a two-state solution right then and there. The Arab nations rejected that. And time again, Palestinians have rejected the opportunity for peace. In 2005, when Gaza was turned over to the Palestinians, and I had visited Gaza before as a child, as a young adult, it was a thriving economic center that could have continued to be a thriving place for a future for Palestinians, and yet they elected Hamas into leadership and then became pawns of these terrorists who used them as shields and continued to attack time and time again Israeli civilians.
Of course, there's the other perspective here. Many feel that Israel has shifted rightward and is now at the mercy of right-wing extremists who would like to occupy the West Bank, Gaza, and nothing more than to displace the people there. Do you not believe that that's part of the situation on the ground as well?
I don't think it's an excuse for what took place on October 7th. I do think that the world has succumbed to a level of extremism.
On both sides.
And we look at it across the globe, whether we want to look at it in the United States, whether we want to look at it in Europe, and Israel has followed suit. You've got some extreme elements in their government, and you've got a whole other audience looking to turn a different way. You know, I'm an Israeli citizen. I look forward to the opportunity to vote there. I also respect the fact that it's a sovereign nation and a democracy.
I wanted to read this quote because it's from someone in our region. It's from that same Washington Post survey I brought up earlier. This is a quote from Bob Haas, 71 years old, business consultant living in Devon, Pennsylvania. When things get tough, the first suspects and therefore the first victims are Jews. So I think the existence of Israel is important to the Jewish people. But the way the Netanyahu government has conducted itself does nothing to safeguard Jews in Israel or around the world. One thing I observe sometimes, and you'll tell me if my observations are off base, that increasingly American Jews do not see Israel and the sort of American involvement in Israel as part of their own self-preservation and protection, as part of the Jewish diaspora. They feel that some sort of alienation from that cause and from that nation-building project. Do you think I'm way off base there? I think that's a little bit of what Bob is expressing in that quote.
So I don't buy the narrative. I'm a person that leans in as opposed to distance myself. I think American Jews, many got way too comfortable here. Anti-Semitism didn't go away. It just went underground for a while. And as we've seen anti-Semitism across the centuries, it morphs like a virus. So first we were hated because of our religion. We were then hated because of our race. And now we're being hated because...
So you're saying American Jews feel too comfortable, and that is why they are more apt to question Israel's actions.
I think there's some of that, yes.
And that is because they have not experienced a level of threat or anti-Semitism in their day-to-day life? Why would that be?
I think that they haven't experienced Israel. Again, so much of what we are seeing and people are experiencing around the Middle East is from snippets in the news. All right, I would say go visit Israel. Go visit the Middle East. Spend some time there. See the multiculturalism of that country. The largest celebration of LGBTQ celebrations take place in Israel. Some of the happiest societies are in Israel. The diversity of Jews, Muslims, Christians.
You believe it's really a fiction based on them not being there. And I would say, I would imagine a lot of them are saying it's based on their experience of seeing destruction and seeing widespread calamity and thinking, I do not want to be a part of that.
I think we're seeing only a slice of the narrative. The same thing can be said in Philadelphia about certain neighborhoods. Oh, I don't want to go into Kensington or mm-hmm. this because it's crime, crime, crime. Yet, you know, most of us who go into those communities, you know, are finding a resurgence of restaurants and life, not just what's being shown on the news. And you have to peel away from that narrative, which has been incredibly one-sided and disruptive.
That's
especially Michael, the UN.
I want to thank Michael Balaban, CEO of the Jewish Federation of Greater Philadelphia, for having this conversation with us today. Really appreciate your time today on the show, Michael.
Thank you, Avi.
A lot of comments are piling up. I will get to some of them soon, but stay tuned to Studio 2. We asked this hour, did the war in Gaza change your perspective on the world in any way? If so, how? And what do you see as the major impediments to a lasting peace in the region? Our number, 888-477-9499. Our email is studio2@whyy.org. Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back. And welcome back to Studio 2 on WHYY. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. Cherry Gregg is off today. Our next guest was born in the West Bank and moved here to Philadelphia at age 4. She has since become a leader in the local Palestinian community, helping to establish Philadelphia's annual Palestine Day 4 years ago. Like our last guest, she makes frequent trips to the region and joins us now to talk about her perspective on the last 2 years. Jude Hussein, welcome to Studio 2.
Thank you so much for having me, Avi.
And our question for our listeners, did the war in Gaza change your perspective on the world at all? If so, how? And what do you see as the major impediments to a lasting peace in the region? Email studio2@whyy.org. Ruth says, it's bothered me that the 20 points, or whatever they call it, talking about this ceasefire plan, was drawn up by only folks who have designs on Gaza, which I suspect they will pursue after the hostage situation is completely settled. Hamas was not part of the negotiations, nor were the people of Gaza. Brian says the biggest impediment for a lasting peace in the Middle East is the current Israeli government and its far-right coalition. As long as they openly show disdain for the Palestinians, on the other side, the Palestinians need to get their act together in forming a governing body, maybe with international guidance, that is not militant-based. Those are perspectives from Ruth and Brian. Jude, I first wanted just to you to explain to folks your connection to the West Bank. I mentioned that you were born there. But you do go back frequently, right? And this has been a sort of your ties there are deep. And I imagine you have been there fairly recently, right?
Yes, absolutely. I just got back about 6 weeks ago. My grandmother is 110 years old.
Wow.
And so both my parents are Palestinian. Our roots date back generations and generations. And so going back is really critical for me because, I mean, we can date ourselves back quite before 1948. And so my grandmother is older than the state, so it kind of is a token for me, for sure.
Give us a sense of what life is like in the West Bank. We don't talk as much about that as we do Gaza, understandably so, but there have been, I understand, some major changes on the ground. So as someone who's been there recently and who had visited before fall 2023, what do you see as the major changes?
So it's really important to have a foundation of what life is like in the West Bank. There is no Hamas in the West Bank, but the Israeli Defense Forces are very, very present. There's over 500 checkpoints in the West Bank. And so think about it from leaving your house in North Philly to getting City Hall, what it's like to stop at least, you know, a dozen times and give, you know, your driver's license, where are you going, those kinds of questions. And as I was there very recently, you know, even though I held a U.S. passport, you know, my U.S. passport was thrown on the ground. I was strip searched. I had like an AK pointed to my temple and said, don't overextend your stay here. And so that's
What were the circumstances of that, if I might ask?
Of course. Yes, it was at a checkpoint between getting to Jerusalem and then leaving Ramallah. And so that's a major city in which I was born. And mm-hmm. so this is real life that happens to every day Palestinians and Palestinian Americans too. And so I like to say I'm Palestinian and American. I don't have to pick between either, and I'm proud to be both. And so,
but would that have happened, you imagine, before? Had that happened to you before, that very intense interrogation that you described? Or is that something that you feel has become more present in the last 2 years.
Absolutely. I think it's happened before, but the intensity has escalated. You know, there's roads for Palestinians and roads for Israelis. And so they even color code the license plates. And I think after October 7th, in which we've seen a higher and a much larger presence of Israeli forces, if you can even imagine that, with over 500 checkpoints in the West Bank. But yes, the hostility is very much there, but it's always been there. Just if you can even escalate it, kind of max it out.
I'm curious if you could go back to October 7th, 2023, and what you imagined would be the response of the Israeli government after that day, if you remember what you thought might happen and how that compares to the reality of what happened.
Well, first I want to say, you know, October 7th, right, we haven't even heard from the Israeli government about the Hannibal directive that they sent out very much that day, where they killed their own citizens. And so, you know, I want to start out by condemning that. I would say to your question of what should the response have been, I mean, well, I'll say this, it shouldn't have been a genocide of over 70,000 Palestinians slaughtered. There shouldn't have been any citizens slaughtered, and we need to hold every single person accountable to that. And so that's my answer for you, Avi.
But I guess I wanted to know if that is what you imagined would happen at the time. Was this predictable to you, or did the ferocity of Israel's assault genuinely surprise you?
It was not predictable, but I don't think anybody could have even imagined a widespread slaughter and famine. I mean, I don't even think our imagination can grasp such cruelty and evil to even picture that this would happen. And so, no, I did not think that, you know, a slow genocide to a rapid genocide in Gaza, which is Palestine, right? I think people like to separate Palestine and Gaza, but this is Palestine. This is Palestinian territory. And so, no, I don't think I could have ever imagined this. And every day we say, I don't think it could get worse, right? I don't think we can, you know, you open up Instagram Live and you have an ongoing genocide where you're watching mothers and men collecting their children's limbs. I mean, you have the largest child amputees in Gaza in our history. And so we say, I don't think it could get worse. And suddenly the very next day it gets absolutely worse. And so, no, I do not think that this widespread and this scale of destruction was even possible.
So given that, that even you did not fathom the possibility of what has occurred, how does it change the way you view America, American politics, the future of this region? These are big questions, right? And I know that you and I are just two people here sitting talking across a table, but there's millions of people reassessing in the wake of this, right? And I wonder how you reassess. Does it diminish your hope? Does it feel completely hopeless?
Well, I'm Palestinian American, and you can never diminish my hope. You know, we always hope for a better world and a better society. That's who we are at our very core. And so that's that first part. I think for the first time since, I believe, the 1980s, we've seen a drastic shift in American perspective. I think a lot of people like to say, you know, Americans don't know too much about geopolitics. And that may be true, but I would like to think, for the first time in our history, we're watching a genocide unfold. And people, with this recent poll, the American mindset has shifted, and they see exactly what's happening. There's only so much you can lie to an American that has everything at their fingertips on their cell phone. And so I think there's a shift that is happening in American politics. I think this is a lesson for the Democrats to know that you can't shy away from something because you think it's a hot topic and it doesn't impact you. But it absolutely does, because we're fueling it with, you know, the arms that we sent over, the billions of dollars of aid that we sent over.
Do you think that shift, though, in sentiment will translate into real change in policy? Because that is something that is a little hard to see at this particular moment. Perhaps you see it. I don't know.
Yeah, I think what we're about to see is, I think what we've seen is the narrative has shifted for the first time in our history. And so I think that's a start for policy shift. And as more people are starting to say, wait, we can't keep slaughtering these people and then starving these people. Like, we have to stop it. And the next question is how. And so I think we've seen the narrative shift of, what is happening in Palestine, this occupation that these Palestinians have been faced with for 8 decades, and now this, you know, rapid genocide that's occurring is wrong. How do we stop it? And so I think the next shift is the how. And so I'm very hopeful that we'll get to some policy changes in the next decade for sure.
Lori says, I lived in Israel for 2 years on a kibbutz in the Negev, just as the Sinai was being returned to Egypt. It was a halcyon time full of hope, but even when I went to Jerusalem, I'm guessing more recently, I saw the second-class status of Arabs in the city. Mm-hmm. The problem is that Israel is a theocracy. I do not believe there's any place for theocracy here in the U.S. or in any democracy. Jay says Trump has made it much less safe for Jews in America today. He always used Israel and Jewish interchangeably, which fuels anti-Semitism. I am curious for your perspective on Trump and what he has done here over his first, let's not say just the last week or two, but his first 9 months or so in office. He will point out rightly that this all began under a prior president, this particular version of the conflict. He will point out that he has achieved what looks like a more promising ceasefire than what the Biden administration did. And I think there are people who believe Trump's iconoclasm, willingness to buck sort of the typical American approach to diplomacy, can yield better results here. Do you believe that?
So I said earlier, the Democrats have a really hard lesson to learn here. I mean, we saw it with the DNC. We saw it with the presidential race where they were trying to shy away from talking about Palestine and the ongoing genocide there of a mass slaughter. And so, yes, the Biden administration didn't reach a ceasefire deal. We have to give it to the Trump administration now, whether or not there will be lasting peace, whether or not, the occupation, the Israeli government will actually withdraw from Gaza is another question in itself. But the fact still stands that there is a ceasefire as it stands right now. Now, the logistics of that ceasefire we can talk about. But yes, I will say that Trump did make a ceasefire happen. We saw him in Egypt this morning. We saw him in Palestine this morning. And so the implementation of it is another conversation.
You say lasting peace. What does that look like to you? What is lasting peace?
Lasting peace is the occupation completely removing themselves from Palestinian territories and really the West Bank. I mean, there's no Hamas in the West Bank. Why the heck are there 500 checkpoints? Why?
That's a security imperative for them, that they need to have eyes and ears on the ground in order to protect Israel. I take it you disagree with that.
Oh, 100%. I mean, listen, when I fill out federal paperwork, I fill out Palestine occupied territories. It's not a surprise that the occupation has Palestinians, under apartheid. This is not my opinion. This is actual fact at hand. And so if everything is a security reason, if a genocide is security reason, if getting to this quote unquote peace deal is all about security, I mean, was it a genocide that got us to this peace deal? I mean, this is just... You cannot fool the American people anymore. I mean, you cannot fool someone that says, wow, like 2.3 million people. And we're talking about this is what security is. I mean, we just have to find a new line to that.
But do you believe lasting peace for you, for mm-hmm. your family, looks like peaceful coexistence with a Jewish state?
I will say that. It's always been peaceful coexistence for generations and generations. We see that in towns like Nablus, where you have Orthodox Jewish homes that live side by side. And so that's always been the case for Palestinians time and time again. Occupation and apartheid does not, when I envision a Palestine, that's not what I envision as peaceful coexistence, no.
As we leave here today, is there anything that gives you hope? Like when you try to channel that hope for some future world, can you get there? Can you channel that hope today?
Absolutely. What gives me hope are the students that stand up and exercise their First Amendment. What gives me hope is American fundamental values of peace, of what we try to aspire to. What gives me hope is my grandmother, who is 110 years old and is, older than the state of Israel and is still thriving, and may God bless her. And so I think there's a lot of things that give me hope, and the basis of being Palestinian is hope and hospitality. And so I'm always, always hopeful for the future for Palestine that is not under occupation and apartheid, and for an America that really upholds those values.
And do you think America will and should play an active role in creating that hopeful future that you laid out? Or would you prefer America stand down?
Well, according to the Trump peace plan, he plans on boarding this chair. He plans on chairing the board of governance. And so I think America played a huge role in sending, you know, billions and billions of dollars of warfare. And so in return, they should play a role in what that rebuilding looks like.
Especially, and you trust that America can play a positive role.
We always have hope. As it stands right now, I mean, we endured over 700 days of constant mass slaughter, which America is complicit in. But no, I believe that we got to let people turn back.
That's Jude Hussein. Want to thank you so much for your time today, founder of Philadelphia Palestine Day. Appreciate your perspective on 2D02.
Thank you, Avi.
Deborah says, interesting slip of the tongue about the head of the Jewish Federation said when he spoke of Hamas crossing our border. Hamas did not cross my border. I am Jewish. I am an American citizen. Hamas did not cross my border. So just one comment among many. Want to thank everyone who participated today in our conversation. Studio 2 is produced by Debbie Builder and Andreas Copes. Mike Schiffler is our visual producer. Al Banks and Tina Calique engineered today's show. Our executive producer is Kevin McCory. From Studio 2 at WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. Thank you so much for joining us, and we will talk to you tomorrow.